Thank you very much, Tom. I find myself in new places often looking up. Sometimes ceilings are interesting, beautiful old tiles or lovely space. And here I was more pragmatic. I was concerned where the projector was going to appear from, and it's here. But I noticed looking up two kings, I think. Is there a story behind that, Tom? How did they get up there, and what are they doing there anyway? You don't know? Maybe it's a nod to the gamblers who originally funded statisticians. It's got to be. We'll look into it. Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me out. It's a real pleasure. It's a great audience and very nice opportunity. This paper is co-authored with Glenn Donaldson out at UBC's Sauder School and Lisa Kramer, who is at the Rotman School. What we're focusing on in this paper has to do with state of the art in terms of point estimates for the equity premium. These estimates range, current estimates, the best guess estimates range from, looking at the data, range from 2.5% to 6 or 7%, and each of those estimates comes with confidence intervals that are disturbingly large. 200 basis points, I think, is about as small as they get, 2% plus or minus, and they go up to 300 or 400 basis points, plus or minus 3 or 4%. Yeah. We're interested in tightening those bounds in this paper, and I'll try to motivate why that might be possible, how this paper follows in a tradition of narrowing these bounds, and how we think made a logical extension of this sort of thought. So first I'll try to describe the basic idea. A typical presentation that I make is to a less technically sophisticated crowd, but I think giving an overview like this is still helpful. The basic strategy here is to look at many moments of the data. Now, the typical estimate of the equity premium comes from a single moment of the data, that is the excess return over the risk-free rate that stocks generate. And typically in this literature, we look at some kind of market measure of return like the S&P 500 if we're talking about the U.S. and some kind of risk-free rate like the U.S. T-bill. So that excess return has floated around 6% for the better part of 150 years looking at the U.S. again. Now, we don't know the joint distribution of the various moments we could calculate for instance, the U.S. economy, the Sharpe ratio, the equity premium, the dividend yield. We can get estimates from the data, but those would be terribly imprecise. So what we're going to try to do is to calibrate to U.S. dividends and interest rates, simple time series models, and use these models to produce false economies, simulated economies. We're going to calibrate to about a half a century worth of U.S. data. We're going to generate simulated economies, each with about a half a century worth of annual returns. And with thousands of such simulations, we're going to calculate thousands of tuples of moments, equity premia, Sharpe ratios, dividend yields and such. And from these thousands of simulations and thousands of tuples of moments, we're going to estimate the joint distribution of these interesting financial statistics and use this set of moments to try to determine what a small range of equity premium estimates seem most consistent with at least the U.S. experience. The number that we come to actually is heartwarming to at least a few friends of ours who are professionals. They believe that the equity premium is about 3.5%, and that is a number that we back out of these simulations. And the confidence interval that we place around that, looking at the data we have available to us, is roughly plus or minus 0.5%, 50 basis points. So this is basically the key contribution of this paper. If you're interested in that number, and if you're interested in just the methodology, then I hope there'll be some reward for you there. We're going to argue that this finding is fairly robust, and I'll talk to you about what I mean by that and as we go along. I'm not sure if I need to encourage this crowd, but certainly questions are welcome at any point. And like Lewis, I'm good at skipping through stuff that's less important if more important issues keep us. Basic definitions, this is probably familiar to all of you, but just to walk through it, the equity premium, this pi, is just the difference in expectations. This falls out of simple asset pricing models, and you don't need a lot of structure to get this as being an important or interesting quantity. The focus on this quantity started with Mayer and Prescott's work about 20 years ago now, which pulled this out of a simple asset pricing model and suggested that this difference historically was far too large, given their theory and model. It can vary. A bill of the bond as the risk-free, what do we calibrate to? I'll talk about that as I go. Basically, we have annual data we're looking at, so we're going to use one-year returns, and those are bills. The way this is calculated is just empirically just the mean, the difference in mean returns and risk-free rates. We're going to be focusing on the S&P 500. A lot of the work in this literature has, so we're just continuing, and it's a reasonable measure of the equity markets, anyways, at least for the U.S. and U.S. T-bills. And as I say, historically, according to at least the original models that were proposed and people's notions of parameters or risk aversion in these models, that difference seemed to be very large, 6%, and even people with just a casual intuitive notion of what markets should be doing found 6% to be a great reward for the risks being undertaken. This seemed too large to a lot of people on a lot of different grounds. I think if it was just a model or two that came out in some academic paper, it wouldn't really have caused up the stir. Hello? Yes? Can't estimate which returns? Any of them. Which angle is this? Rob. Okay. Well, that's an interesting statement. I don't always disagree with Nobel laureates, but Rob and I have had a few fights, so he usually wins, it's true. He's a smart guy. I'll talk a little bit about how that's defined in the context of what I'm doing, and I think that it's certainly true that the standard error on those returns is so large that one might express lack of confidence in the point estimate. And really what this paper is about determining more confidence in what this difference should be. And this difference is not quite as variable as just the returns, but it's very variable. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. Maybe that's what Rob meant. I don't know. So in terms of the literature and how this paper fits in, there's a variety of approaches that are meant to look at the puzzle. This really isn't a paper about the puzzle or trying to resolve the puzzle, but it's certainly related to that literature. Literature started up and continues with a great deal of work in terms of theoretical asset pricing models. And to resolve the puzzle, people have asked the question, maybe there's something wrong with the model. So if the model's giving us a great big puzzle where we need the level of risk aversion of investors to be so large to justify this return that it just doesn't seem reasonable, maybe the model's too simple. The original models were, there was no sort of dependence over time, and very simple model, elegant, but very simple. So models have been extended to have habit persistence and different sorts of subtleties that we might think are reasonable. So basically they're trying to boost up the level of the equity premium that would be reasonable coming out of those models. So it's just a way to rationalize the number that comes out of the data rather than trying to pick a new number. And although I think that's an interesting exercise, it's important to have the right number, or at least a small range of numbers to consider before you start trying to rationalize the numbers that have coming that are coming out of the data. There's also been some work that has suggested, very forcefully, that the estimates may just be too high. There's so much variability and imprecision in returns in particular, that maybe we need to try to figure out some other way to estimate the equity premium. So there's some work by Fama and French in 2002 that suggested that the dividend yield should be a sort of long-run estimate of the expected return. So instead of using backward-looking historic estimates, the actual realized return, why don't we use current prices and dividends to get an idea of what the market expects returns going forward to be. A very clever work, a slightly different moment of the data to get at the expected return. There's also been some work that's tried to incorporate restrictions from reasonable restrictions on the data, some Bayesian work by Pasteur and Stambaugh recently in the Journal of Finance again, which suggested that price increases are probably associated with declines in the equity premia. If the equity premia declines, there should be an abrupt response by people to bid up prices, given the same expected cash flow in the future, and making use of that sort of notion to condition on that bit of information to estimate the equity premium differently. Very clever, interesting work. The Fama and French estimates and used yield ratios, including earnings and dividend yields, and they got it as low as 2.5%. Depending on what they did, they're 3.5% and 4.5%. So kind of pick the yield you think is most reasonable and you'll come up with an estimate of the equity premium. Still plus or minus 2 percentage points on their point estimates, and Pasteur and Stambaugh I think came up with a little over 5% as what it is recently, incorporating structural breaks and all, but still plus or minus about 2% on their point estimates. So still some issues there. What we're going to do is extend this notion of looking at other moments, looking at combinations of financial moments now, and looking at joint tests to determine a range to invert the distribution effectively and take the probability values to give us point estimates is what it amounts to. So we're going to try to use these joint distributions with the from the U.S. and the point estimate from the U.S. data to get an idea of what range of equity premium seem most consistent. Basically, the experiments are going to involve around setting equity ex ante equity premium and seeing what comes out of them, and looking at the U.S. experience to see if it seems consistent with what came out of a particular ex ante equity premium. Big fingers and tapping too many keys at once. So I'm going to go over the methodology again in a little more detail. So we start with a range of ex ante equity premium that we think are a reasonable range. For some of the experiments, we went down as low as 1% and as high as 8 or 9%, going up 25 or 50 basis points at a time, essentially doing a grid of values of ex ante equity premium for each point on that line. We conducted the same sort of experiment. So we set this equity premia at some percentage point, assume a value, and then we're for all these equity premia, we have the same basic models for dividends and interest rates. We use these models to simulate out a variety of paths for U.S. dividends and interest rates. The idea being, if you start with an initial condition, you know how dividends evolve over time, and you know how interest rates evolve over time, and you know what the equity premium is, the ex ante equity premium, the true equity premium. You either know what its constant value is or how it evolves over time. Then you can trace out possible paths that the economy could have followed. It didn't, but it could have. And then ask yourself the question over all these paths, which sort of ex ante equity premium seem most consistent with what actually evolved in the U.S. And amongst those, out of those paths, what's interesting to us are some summary statistics. U.S. dividends? I mean the dividends. We're going to model dividend growth rates of the dividends. That's what we're going to end up modeling, but it's based on the U.S. dividends. there's a couple of robustness checks we need to do when we consider that. Up until late 1970s, dividends paid as recorded were most of the cash flows actually went to investors. After the late 70s, companies, I'm not sure exactly why, partly tax treatments, they shifted the way they paid cash out to shareholders. Sometimes they did buybacks, sometimes they did just one-time cash payouts that didn't show up as regular dividends. And so those are effectively dividends. You don't get them unless you sell your shares, but you could have, and that's. Absolutely, that's a very important question. Most of the experiments we calibrate just to straight dividends, which means we underestimate the mean dividend growth rate from the last half of our sample, effectively. And that's why we did this experiment with a break, essentially, in the late 70s, where the growth rate went up. That's a good question. Thank you. A little bit of notation, probably also familiar. The price in the market of an equity or an index, which you can think of as, I guess, a large conglomerate, is equal to the expected value of the price next period plus the cash payments you receive over that period, discounted appropriately. And appropriately in this context, we've got an explicitly partial equilibrium environment. We're really only exploiting the use of the law of one price, and we're using the risk-free rate plus some kind of equity premium to capture the appropriate discounting. You can rewrite that, drawing out the prices and using the transversality condition that in the limit the discounted value of the price of the equity goes to zero, pull out the dividends and write this all in terms of growth rate of dividends and this discount rate, so the sum product of dividend growth rates and interest rates. We're actually going to end up modeling the growth rates and the interest rates, modeling them as time-dependent, co-varying random variables. So the growth rate is just the arithmetic. And this Y variable is something that I don't think in this paper we use very much, but you can model that instead of the growth rates and interest rates separately if you like. That can be a simpler way to model these sorts of things. So in terms of these Y's, it's got a nice simple representation. So sometimes that's more straightforward to model, and it does make explicit or maybe a little more obvious that if interest rates and dividend growth rates are time dependent, then evaluating this expectation can be troublesome. Now, the standard Gordon growth model and typical approaches make simplifying assumptions in order to evaluate that expectation. So if dividend growth rates are constant, or at least conditionally unpredictable, and interest rates are constant, then it's pretty easy to simplify this into a simple dividend growth model. And if they're not, it's not easy. Anyone who prices path-dependent options will recognize a similar problem. So the returns we're going to consider are these arithmetic. It's kind of standard, just annual stuff. So arithmetic seems reasonable. In terms of the simulation, you know, we're not the first people to do a simulation to investigate properties such as this. There is a large, rich literature. Pretty much all of this literature does rely on analytic simplifications to get solutions to the problem. They often still have to do a simulation to investigate some properties or issues, but often what's simulated are basically the returns directly or the prices directly, and they get that through either the Gordon growth style assumptions to get a simplified price, or through some log linearization work of Campbell and Schiller. Brilliant work, I love it. The log linearization allows them to also solve this analytically or very nearly and approximate this sort of stuff. I have some issues, however, with this sort of work in terms of its usefulness for some questions. These sorts of simplifications, analytic approximations, lead to unreal outcomes. They lead to models that suggest dividend yield should be constant or very nearly so, for one thing. They lead to very, very smooth returns. The excess volatility puzzle is the partner to the equity premia puzzle. And they really do go hand in hand. Excess volatility of returns comes out of these models that simplify how dividends and interest rates evolve over time. You know, these models lead to implications that would suggest to someone who believed the models, for instance, that there are bubbles in stock market prices everywhere all the time and always will be. You cannot find a stock market in the world that hasn't violated the sorts of implications that come out of these models. And they're not trivial or violations or inconsequential. They're startling. Dividend yields are nowhere near constant. In fact, they're highly autocorrelated. AR1 coefficient of about 0.8. Extremely volatile over time. Gross violations of the sorts of implications that come out of these sorts of simplified models. And the excess volatility that comes out of real-world returns is also startling compared to how smooth returns should be if you believe in the dividend growth sorts of the Gordon growth sort of models. So what we're going to do is simulate dividend growth and discount rate processes directly and evaluate that expectation through numeric integration. It was completely infeasible 20 years ago and just completely out of the question 50 years ago, but we can do it today pretty straightforwardly. There is enormous amounts of serial correlation in dividend growth rates. An MA1 or AR1 fits them pretty well, but it's hard to ignore the amount of autocorrelation that's in dividend growth rates and earnings growth rates, for that matter. Interest rates are, well, you know, if you're going to have a fight about anything in terms of interest rates, what you're going to fight about is whether or not they follow a unit route, whether or not they're non-stationary, not whether or not they're constant or independent over time. They're so highly autocorrelated, startling. If you believe that discount rates on bonds tell us something about the overall economy's notion of what the discount rate should be on a risk-free asset, then it's hard to ignore this sort of thing. So we're not going to. What differentiates these sorts of simulations in this work has to do with that sort of stuff, the same way we simulate things. What time do I have till 7? Or the tolerance of the audience, one or the other. 7. So just to give you a sense, again, a little more intuition, we're going to start with some initial conditions for each of these simulations. We're going to have some lag dividend growth rates, some interest rate going forward, some dividend, and we're going to ask the question, what are the possible paths that we could follow from this starting point, given we know what the process is for dividend growth rates and interest rates, and we know how they co-vary. So there's many possible paths. Each of these P's represent basically an ex post rational price. That's the price that you would have paid if you'd known what the interest rate and dividend growth rate was all the way along, and you don't change your discount rate because you know what the truth is going to be. So that's just the discounted value that's appropriate to that stream. Now, we don't know which of these J streams will actually unfold. So we take an expectation, we just average, that's all it is. The paths that are most likely are the ones that are best represented, and so the average is one, you know, reasonable estimate of what investors' expectation for the price should be given these initial conditions. Yes? Is there any correlation between those prices? That's just built into this. I haven't explored that explicitly there. Basically different possible paths. The sense in which they're correlated is the, are you talking about the ex post rational prices at the end? We're simulating like an index market. So we don't have a cross section of assets that we're simulating. That's an interesting question that one of my co-authors wrote a grant application to investigate, a kind of asset pricing model where you explore implications of covarying assets with these sorts of tools. But that's not what I'm going to do right now. Thank you. Thank you. So the data again, U.S. Dividends and interest rates. We're not going to calibrate to returns or prices. Okay, we haven't done anything, you know, obviously sneaky, anyways. We're going to look at annual data, 1 year T-bill rates over 52 to 2002, 51 years of data. The longer it takes us to finish this project, the more data we have to have and restart things. But what are you going to do? The models for the interest rates and dividends, well, I'm going to look at a set of models. What I'm showing you today is circa about 6 months ago, and we're changing our models a little bit, trying to incorporate the sorts of common things that people would cough about when they would see this sort of stuff. We're going to simulate with either an AR1, an ARMA, or an ARMA 1-1 of the logarithm of interest rates. It's for non-negativity constraints, and the logarithm of 1 plus dividend growth rate. These models work very well at cleaning the data of residual autocorrelation, and the residuals that come out of those models appear to pass common specification tests. They don't seem to have much in the way of anything left, actually. Annually, there isn't as much in the data as you might find if you had higher frequency. And the error terms in these two models are positively correlated, as you might guess they might be. We also consider a variety of different models for the equity premium, including time-varying versions. At first, you know, I wasn't very enthusiastic about having time-varying equity premium at all, since it is so hard to estimate even the mean of the equity premium to delude yourself into believing you could estimate its time-varying properties when it is just so enormously noisy, seemed to be futile. But, you know, people just want to see it because they believe in their heart that the equity premium is time-varying, and maybe it is. So we picked a classic model, Merton's CAPM, for the market. You can estimate a kind of conditional mean return out of that using dividend yields and the sort of structure in it. And it does behave kind of sensibly. So, you know, maybe they're right. It actually looks a lot like interest rates, interestingly enough, in terms of its volatility over time and dependence over time. Question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, when you put S&P returns for your analysis, but S&P constitution keeps on changing year over year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how do you adjust for that?
Well, the question is about S&P constitution changing over time. It's an index, and is it non-stationary in some sense or other? Well, the people who put together the S&P 500, their goal, first of all, when a firm is liquidated out of the index, the cash is used to basically purchase another firm. So there's no inconsistency over time in the sense that you're dropping money into the pot and increasing what's in there or affecting the return dynamics in that way. And the idea of changing it over time is to keep it similar over time rather than to let it drift into something odd. If we'd froze it, you know, from the 1930s, for instance, there'd be a lot more emphasis on railway stocks and probably T-shirt manufacturers for men, and there probably wouldn't be any computers in there. And, you know, I mean, it has to change over time to basically be the same in relation to the rest of the economy. The way I really think about any index, including the S&P 500, is that it is effectively a conglomerate, a large company. And just as companies do, the index sheds some arms and buys others. And if they're doing the job right, it shouldn't affect the fundamental properties of the index. It should be essentially the same over time. Question?
If it's changing over time and it is depending on the constituents, that means the returns would be highly dependent on the constituents in the sense that if they're focused on an industry, let's say utilities,
mm-hmm.
then the returns on utilities are pretty constant. It should have a smoothing effect on the curve.
Well, the S&P 500 is meant to broadly categorize the U.S. economy and capture 70% or so of the asset value of equities that are publicly traded in the U.S. And the people who form this index are very focused on maintaining that sort of mix and representation. I think of it as being a little bit like the Miller-Modigliani assumptions, which say that you're going to talk about irrelevance of dividend policy and this sort of thing, then you have to make an assumption that the investment policy isn't going to change dependent on your dividend payouts. What the point of the people forming the constituents of the S&P 500 is basically to maintain a strategy in terms of investment in the broader economy. To the extent the economy changes over time, it will change over time. Its relationship to the economy, you know, we hope doesn't change over time. So, I mean, you can't really get away from that. IBM is not the same as it was 50 years ago, even if you just had it. It used to literally make typewriters and changed a lot since then. Even Microsoft, God forbid, is changing over time. So, it's true, Nortel really did a job on. Yeah. It's hard. You can make that argument, but I mean, I won't laugh at that argument. It's reasonable, but I don't really think it compromises this effort. Thank you. So the kinds of time variant equity premium we're going to look at involve basically the most commonly sought after or thought about autocorrelated equity premium, which make a little bit of sense in terms of habit persistence and this sort of stuff. Trending equity premium, people believe that it has trended downward, and there's some empirical work, Pastor and Stambaugh, to support that. Pastor Nsamba also argued for structural breaks in equity premium. So we're going to look at kind of a variety of models. Well, we're not sure about the equity premium. Are we sure about our model estimates? We're going to try to incorporate as best we can parameter uncertainty. So we'll basically, when we estimate our models for dividend growth rates and interest rates, they come with parameters, and those parameters come with parameter estimates. And we're going to sample from the distribution and joint distribution of those parameter estimates to pull out models to simulate with, and we're going to integrate over them, which is it's not formally a Bayesian analysis, but it's Bayesian style integration over those parameter distributions. There was a question? Oh. Well, you know, it's all in there. I view 9/11 and 1987's credit crunch and price reaction and the 29 disaster, although that's not in our data set, I view those as part of the random shocks that buffet the economy, and you know, they're in there. Do they affect dividends? I don't think they probably affect dividends very much. Do they affect interest rates? I'm not sure if they do. I mean, certainly the Federal Reserve responds to some crises. Would it affect annual interest rates much? I'm not sure. But remember, when we compare the returns that come out of this and Sharpe ratios and all, we don't condition on the returns that came out of the real economy. We just look at those fundamental series. So to the extent that our model can produce volatility and such in returns that match on a real economy buffeted by such enormous shocks, you know, I guess that's going to mitigate our ability to match some moments of the data, but we'll get to how well we do. Thank you. Yeah, 9/11 is why we have all those sorts of shocks, they lead to an equity premium, absolutely. Thank you. So a quick look at the DGPs, the data generating processes, the models that we use, and the set of experiments I'm going to present here. We've got the three different types of equity premium. We're considering the AR1, the trended, the braked. We've got parameter uncertainty and agents being uncertain. That is, when I generate the real data, I generate it from a random draw from the distribution of the parameters, and then I have the agents estimate their own models from the data that gets generated 50 years of data. So I've got uncertainty on both ends, and I also consider cases where there is no uncertainty, no time variant equity premium and such, breaks in the equity premium, including certain kinds of drops, trends, 1 or 2%, this sort of stuff. So it's not, it can never be complete, I guess, but I hope it covers a broad cross-section. We're trying to introduce a little more in the way of parameter and agent uncertainty in this, so that they estimate over a group of models and look at a broader range of models as well. just to give you a sense for what the data can look like, this is the ex post equity premium that comes out of our simulations for a variety of ex ante equity premium that went in. So if we started with a 2% ex ante equity premium and then we did these simulations, we did 2,000 economies, so these percentiles are draws from that ranked set of 2,000 economies. We should be getting a mean ex post equity premium that's pretty close to the ex ante. If we did enough simulations, it should be exact. The simulation error was made to be as small as was practical. We actually had to do a simulation of our simulations to get the Monte Carlo simulation error because it wasn't analytically tractable. You only get tractable standard errors under very simple conditions. That was fun. So the medians show a bit of a skew, which is not unreasonable given this is something that shouldn't go too negative but can go quite positive, and show fairly broad confidence intervals. So here the 90% confidence interval for the 2% case goes from negative 3% up to over 5%. If we look at a 6% ex ante equity premium, we get a 90% confidence interval that goes over 8 to just above 2. So you get the kind of range of outcomes that support the standard error estimates we get empirically from the ex post equity premium in our economy. If you look at returns and the excess return to owning stocks, the variability of that would suggest the same sort of magnitude of confidence interval. So that's reassuring. The excess volatility puzzle isn't much of a puzzle when you do these simulations. Now, I'll get to joint distributions, but first some marginals. So what I have here are probability density functions, distribution functions, for interesting quantities that come out of our simulations. Here's the ex post equity premia, ex post for various ex ante equity premia. Down here, the lowermost PDF is for the 2%, it might be a 1%, I can't remember which I plotted up here, ex ante equity premium up to a, let's see, this is probably, this last one is probably an 8% ex ante equity premium. So what we see from that, the column of large dots in the middle here in each of these plots, this is the U.S. value. So the ex post equity premium for the U.S. is a little over 6%, and we see that it's not really in the tail of any of these distributions. So what we're saying is just looking at that particular moment of the data from our simulation suggests that it's never going to be very useful, at least with 50 years of data, to rule out ex ante equity premium. That true ex ante equity premium could be as low as 1 or 2% or as high as 6 or 8%, and we're still never in the tail of the distribution with the U.S. experience. So can't rule out really any range. One could call it pathetic. It's not a very good indicator. The dividend yield is a little more useful. I'm sorry, it's a bit of a mess. Basically, a couple of the lower ones and a couple of the upper ones are ruled out. We're far in the tail. But the middle ex ante equity premia, we're not out in the tail of those distributions with the U.S. experience. The U.S. dividend yield, I think, is a little under 3%, is it? It bobs around a bit, but I guess here it shows it as being about a little over 3%. In terms of the mean return, again, we're not really out in the tail for any of these ex ante equity premia. The return standard deviation, again, we're not out. There is no excess volatility puzzle from our experiments. The distributions are quite broad for those quantities. Okay, I'm running a little short on time, so these are some other probability density functions. These are two conditional ones, that AR1 and ARCH coefficients are really very uninformative in terms of what the ex ante equity premium likely is. Well, this is just telling us that univariate statistics aren't going to help us much. We probably want to go to a multivariate test, a chi-squared test, as opposed to just a PDF. So where we started, basically saying that one moment's not going to be enough. So we're going to look at chi-squared tests. We're going to look at joint tests based on the mean return, return standard deviation, dividend yield, and ex post equity premium. And these are plots of the rejection rates for different ex ante equity premia for different statistics. models 1, 2, and 3, or the first three models I put up in that slide of models I was going to consider, I'd consider those probably the most reasonable models. This is the joint test up here in this first panel, panel A. Panels B, C, and D give us the individual tests. Individual tests we see from panels B, C, and D are not terribly informative. They don't rule out very many ex ante equity premia. We only get strong rejections, p-values that are low, in narrow ranges, effectively. So individually, these moments aren't very informative for ruling out what the ex ante equity premium likely is. Jointly, when we pull them together, well, of course, the mean return, when we go very low, tends to reject the ex ante equity premium, and the dividend yield and the return standard deviation tend to reject when we go high. When you throw all these together in a joint distribution, you'd expect that you'd have a bit of a tent, and that's essentially what we get. We cut it off at 15% just to compress the scale, but basically we have a peak at around 3.5% in terms of maximizing the rejection rate for a given set of ex ante equity premia for a range of models. So of the most reasonable models, we'd argue that there's a very small range of ex ante equity premia that are consistent with the U.S. experience. That's what's really coming out of this. I don't know if you need this intuition. Basically, this is just a bivariate distribution as opposed to a four-dimensional distribution, which I could wave about but not do much more about. So in terms of bivariates, if we looked at mean return and return standard deviation, if we go from 2% up to 7%, we see the distribution shifting in ways that are predictable. The return, of course, shifts up, and the volatility of the returns tends to decline as we have higher equity premium. And the dark circle around the cloud, the dark circle is asymptotic, I think 99% confidence interval, and the dots are the realizations from our 2000 simulations, mean returns and return standard deviations. Question? Pardon me? The correlation between those two moments? No, but absolutely, they're not spherical, they're elliptical. Yeah, and if the returns were normally distributed, it would be spherical because normal, mean, and variance are independent. These are log normal, and there is a correlation which basically is exploited with these tests. I didn't calculate what that correlation is. It's not that it's not an interesting quantity. I just didn't. So it just gives you a sense for how you can get more power. The return standard deviation doesn't allow us to rule out any of the ex ante equity premia, and the return mean doesn't allow us to rule out very many either, but the two together show that we're often at the edge of a cloud of economies. And basically with the four moments we look at, we do an even better job of getting away from the center of that cloud. And these are just the ellipses as opposed to all the economies, all the actual realizations. So this is going from a low ex ante equity premium up to the high, just to show you how it transitions. And here's the mean dividend yield and ex post equity premium together, how it shifts up and moving through the... Or did I describe what these are? I'm sorry. These crosshairs are the points for the U.S. economy realization. So the ex post equity premium for the U.S. is a little over 6. And the mean interest rate was a little over 6, so they intersect here. We'd ideally like our ellipses to surround that point with some distance on either side, not the outside of it. We originally titled this paper Stare Down the Barrel. The crosshairs looked like a weapon, but maybe it came from living in Georgia at the time. I don't know. There are guns down there. Every year, one or two people get their heads blown off walking in a park and forgetting that it was deer hunting season, and you can hunt deer anywhere in Georgia. And typically the judge would rule that they're idiots for walking in a park without, bright red things and clothing. Anyways, so we got rid of the crosshair, but it's still in our paper. So the dividend yield and Sharpe ratio are kind of interesting. We really see the distribution spreading out here. and the mean interest rate in X plus equity premium, there's a sharp negative relationship. One way people have expressed the equity premium puzzle is not maybe high returns, but low interest rates. And what we see in a very obvious way is that we'd expect if we're going to have high ex post equity premium, we would have low interest rates, just almost mechanically is what it amounts to. It certainly comes out of these simulations. The models 4 through 7, they had things like no time-varying equity premium or no model uncertainty or parameter uncertainty make for stronger rejections. Essentially, those models are getting closer and closer to dividend growth style models with less and less uncertainty and less structure. I should say more and more structure in that way. And you get stronger rejections. So it's hard to really accept any of the ex ante equity premium with some of these models. Okay. We'd argue that this is probably evidence that we're rejecting the model rather than the data in terms of what we've done. So we've tried to pull together this simulation method to evaluate this joint distribution of financial statistics. We'd argue, I don't know if you'd agree by now, but we'd argue that these results are fairly robust to changes in values that we calibrate our simulations to. We can only really get non-results if we move to models that we'd argue are pretty unreasonable. And the extensions that we have underway are going to be to look at a richer class of time series models and richer ways of parameterizing agent uncertainty. Will we look at any non-U.S. markets? Well, we're not opposed to that in principle. It's just a question of data and interest, honestly, in the outcome. People have looked at a broad cross-section of markets across the world and argued that if you look at this broad cross-section, including markets that collapsed at various points, you get a lower estimate of the equity premium, and we shouldn't just focus on basically the single economy that's been very robust over the past 100 years. Understand the argument. If you look at a net capitalization, the U.S. is 40% of the world market capitalization in terms of tradable equities. So you're still going to have a big weight on the U.S. equity markets, even in that case. And many of the markets that went bust were very small markets and have all sorts of corporate governance problems and other issues. And it's already a stretch, honestly, as a finance person, to call a lot of economies behaving anything like the principles that we ascribe to them to derive all of our implications about efficient markets and all. And to go to a place like Argentina that's had currency crises and then argue that we can make something of equity returns in that country just seems to me to be a real stretch. So to me, using Egypt's equity markets and putting them on equal footing with the U.S. just... U.K. would be interesting. Yeah, it's got a long market. But. And Canada would be interesting. So, thanks very much.
Are there any further questions?